57. One for the army, one for the Lord. For the first 2 days of the journey to Esquimalt, Modo was so exhausted that he mostly slept in his cabin on the Shar. The ship's surgeon did what he could for his hand, resetting the bones, but predicting he'd never have full use of it again. Modo didn't correct him, but knew it would be good as new in a few weeks. That's just how his body worked. He wasn't allowed to see Mr. Socrates, who had not yet fully recovered. Tharpa assured him, though, that Sahib had already complained about the quality of the tea, a sign that he was on the mend. When he wasn't sleeping, Modo pulled on his mask and wandered along the deck and stared out at the ocean. Or he sat with Octavia, saying little. She, too, was exhausted. He ate sparingly, the grey sludge still being the only food on offer. Only 2 days out, and already he couldn't stomach much more of it. On one of his visits to the ship's surgeon, he discovered that Miss Hakandottir's life had been saved by cauterizing her stub. She didn't let out a peep, the surgeon said, amazed. She was now manacled in a holding cell somewhere below deck. Dr. Hyde was in a cell on another floor. Both were guarded by several marines. Modo had no intention of visiting his enemy. He hoped the hangman's rope awaited her and Dr. Hyde. All of the dragoons were on the Shar too, though he rarely saw them. He was happy that Esther had survived and seemed to have no injuries. It wasn't until the third day that he ran across Oppie on the deck, sitting on a crate in the sun. The gash on his forehead had been nicely stitched. "Mr. Modo," he said, with a broad smile, "it's a pleasure to see you, sir. We made it through to the other side." "Indeed, we did," Modo answered. He sat beside him. It was still so strange that this man, who such a short time ago was a small boy, was now taller than Modo. A scruffy beard was attempting to grow on his face. "How are you?"
"All's well. I miss me mates. Three of them gave their lives. But I guess we all knew our chances going into this."
"Yes, you did. You are a very brave man, Oppie."
"Just did my job," he answered. "Some terrible things happened, sir. Truly terrible things."
Then he laughed.
"But we got the bastards, didn't we, sir?"
Modo could only nod in response, then return his gaze to the horizon. They were silent for a few minutes. Modo remembered what Mr. Socrates had said about these dragoons. Every week they aged a month. "What will you do now, Oppie?"
"Do, sir?"
"Yes, are you going back to England?"
"I'll be going wherever the army tells me to go, sir," he said.
"You don't get leave? Or perhaps you've done your part?"
"I certainly think so."
"You could move on." Oppie looked him in the eyes.
"Do you really believe there's a place for me in that other world, sir? My job at the inn again?"
"Ha!
No, this is my place now.
My home is with my mates and the Lucky Sevens. No one else can wear my uniform, sir. There's still work for the association to do."
"Yes," Modo said, though he felt for Oppie.
"I suppose you're right. But listen, Oppie, you'll keep learning to read, I hope."
"I will, sir," he replied. "That's a promise."
Modo clapped him on the back and strode to the aft of the ship, his eyes set on the direction from which they'd come. How many times had he walked around this ship, avoiding his most important conversation? He contemplated the view for several minutes before he found the courage to go down the stairs to the lower deck, past the surgeon's quarters to the recovery cabin. His mother had been here all this time, with reports on her health being delivered to his cabin a few times a day. He lingered outside her door, having suddenly decided he should be bringing her a gift. She was his mother, after all. But it wasn't as though he could just dive off the ship and return with a bouquet of flowers. She would have to take him as he was. Perhaps she'd see his part in her rescue as a gift. Perhaps she'd even be proud of him. He adjusted his mask, then raised a hesitant hand and knocked. A frail voice said,
"Entrez."
He opened the door. Her room, lit only by the porthole, was relatively large for a cabin. It was littered with medical equipment and various supplies. His mother lay on her cot, propped up on pillows, a grey wool blanket covering her legs. He took two steps in and stopped. Some colour had returned to her cheeks, though she was still pale. He didn't know what to say. He stared at her face, looking for familiar features.
"Parlez-vous français?"
she asked.
"Oui," he said. "Je comprends." "I am told that you saved me,"
she said in French.
"I remember you, though, as you know, I was not well. I thank you."
"It was my duty," he said. "I was only doing my duty."
"Still, I thank you. It was brave of you."
"Are you feeling better?" he asked. "Are you getting enough to eat?"
"Soldiers bring me horrible food. But the doctor speaks some French. He's not a religious man, but he's kind. He told me my husband is dead. I have not had any tears to weep yet. They will come. I've been praying for his soul. Had I died, it wouldn't have been so bad to join him again in heaven."
Modo didn't know how to respond except to say, "I'm sorry for your loss."
"What's your name?"
she asked.
"Modo." "What sort of name is that? British?"
"My name was..."
He paused. What to say? He began again. "It's the name my father gave me." He hadn't meant to say father, but trying to explain his relationship with Mr. Socrates was too complicated otherwise. "My adoptive father," he added. She nodded.
"He has raised you well. But why do you wear a mask? Were you wounded?"
"I'm disfigured," he said. "At least some would believe that to be so." She raised her eyebrows.
"How did it happen?"
"At birth," he said. "I was born this way." Her eyes narrowed. Was she thinking about his birth? He had to spit it out.
"I know you will find this difficult to believe, but I have learned that I was born in Nanterre. I am your son."
"You're lying," she said. Her eyes grew hard, her face like stone.
"It isn't a lie. The nursemaid's name was..."
He searched his memory. "What had Colette said?"
"Marie. And you left me at Notre Dame Cathedral. You left me there with Father Murger. Don't you remember?"
He hadn't intended to sound so whiny.
"I have no son," she replied. "My husband and I had no children."
Doubt crept in, but her eyes were so similar to his. He thought about all the facts. No, she had to be his mother.
"Tell me the truth. You owe me that, especially now. Did you not give up your son to the Notre Dame orphanage?"
Her face grew tired looking, and she sighed deeply, picking at her fingernails.
"I prayed. I asked my God why he had given me an abomination. What had I done to deserve this? And my husband was a good, hard-working man. So it was me. My sinful thinking. Temptations I could not resist in my youth. So I gave the abomination up to the ones who would know what to do with it. You are not that child. You are only being cruel to me by pretending."
"What year was it?" She paused to think.
1858.
"And this abomination? Did you give him a name?"
"Why would I? It was a punishment visited on me for my sins. My family disowned me. We chose to change our names, to hide from them and from those who knew about God's punishment. I have been praying for his forgiveness ever since."
"Did you give your son anything?"
"I gave him his life. I gave him back to God."
"And if you could see him again, what would you say?"
"One does not speak to the devil."
He wanted to rip off his mask, show her his tortured face, really punish her. The room was blurring. He breathed deeply, blinked back tears, and summoned all of his courage.
"I am your son," he said. "It's the truth.
Whether or not you are willing to accept it is your own problem. She covered her face.
Please, go. Go. Stop torturing me.
He thought of changing his shape, of showing her how magical he was, how powerful and strong. But no. I am Moda, he said. I am your son who saved your life. He left the room, closing the cabin door firmly behind him.